You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, February 12th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Aziz Rana, professor of constitutional law at Cornell Law University, on his piece, Goodbye Cold War. Meanwhile, record spending approved. Trump insistent that none of that spending goes towards helping people. Immigration takes the floor in the Senate while ICE continues its rampage and Teamsters prep to fight back. No longer a General John Kelly, still a liar and a scumbag. And the number three after Sessions and Rod Rosenstein at DOJ steps down. What does she know that we don't? White House wants to privatize the space station. Just going to let that sink in. And what's the point of the United States of Care? A new Pod Save America sanctioned healthcare initiative. And lastly, the intelligence community's inspector general has shut down their own whistleblower report because it shows that the intelligence communities have been horrible when it comes to whistleblowers. That's the Inspector General. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. It is another week of programming. Just a heads up. Next week, we will be on vacation. For most of you, that will mean nothing. For the vast majority of you. For 95% of our audience. Because we will have all new interviews. And frankly, we've almost done all of them. Next week's going to be awesome. In fact, I think you could probably not even listen this week and just go to next week, except for the great offerings that we'll have for you this week. So just keep listening. Don't forget, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And that's what keeps this show, the free part of the show, going. And then, as a way of saying thank you, we give you a bonus material every day. Folks, I haven't been doing as much haze as of late. So I haven't been shaving as much. And my fear was that when I let my beard grow out, then when I shave, I'm going to have all sorts of problems. I have sensitive skin. I'm a very sensitive person.
No, you will not have problems.
But every time I am not disappointed. I'm surprised, frankly. I guess that's what I'm saying. By my Harry's razor. Now, as you know, Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price. They've stripped out the unnecessary features like those massive plastic containers that are, you buy these things at the, the drugstore. And they deliver a perfect razor at an amazing price. In fact, with Harry's, you'll get quality blades for just $2 each compared to the $4 you'll pay at the drugstore. All products are backed by a 100% quality guarantee. No wonder over 3 million guys have switched to Harry's. Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades, they'll give you their free, or I should say their trial shave set for free when you sign up at harrys.com/majorityreport. You just pay for the shipping. You can claim your free trial offer from Harry's today, a $13 value for free when you sign up. Just cover shipping. You get a weighted ergonomic razor handle, That's one of my favorite parts about it, to be honest with you. A 5-precision engineered blade with lubricating strip and a trimmer blade. That's also helpful if you have, and I've mentioned this before, asymmetrically shaped nostrils like myself. I don't show that around to people a lot, but that's the case. And a travel blade cover. You can get your free trial set. Go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report right now. Now, oh, all right. Okay, let's do this. We were anticipating getting a we've done a little bit of reporting here, and there's this story that was just released this morning in Boston, and it is Black History Month, as you know, and in Boston, the police department decided to celebrate it via social media, and here's how they do it. Let's throw to Channel 4, WBZ, to tell you that story.
New tonight, Boston police first posted and then took down a tweet celebrating Black History Month after getting swift criticism from people online.
At around 6:30 tonight, BPD posted a tweet saying, "In honor of Black History Month, we pay tribute to Celtics legend Red Auerbach, the first NBA coach to draft a black player in 1960. He also hired Bill Russell as the league's first black head coach." In response to the tweet, some commented it was insensitive that during Black History Month, BPD would celebrate a white man. About an hour later, the tweet was taken down. We've asked the Boston Police Department for a response on why the tweet was removed and are still waiting to hear back.
Yeah, I have a feeling they're going to be waiting a long time. But, however, as you know, I grew up in the Boston area and I still have local connections. We have some breaking news. I just received from an anonymous tipster. I mean, it's anonymous to you. It's not anonymous to me. Apparently, audio recording from internal in the Boston Police Department of the guy who tweeted out the stuff, reporting back to his superiors as to what's going on. I have it on my phone. I can't obviously share it with Matt because I don't want to reveal a source. But let's listen to it now. I have not listened to it. It just came in.
In honor of Black History Month, we pay tribute to Celtics legend Red Auerbach for being the first NBA coach to draft a black player. Whoa. Hey, Sergeant, why is this thing blowing up on me? I'm getting all kinds of people are tweeting back at me or something.
There you go. That was apparently the the guy who tweeted it out.
Tried to do something for him.
They did it. It sounds like they were tweeting from the car, and it's so there it is. Yeah.
Do you think they call guys that don't use their service weapon unnecessarily? Like, oh, that's a real Red Auerbach we got over here. Yeah. He didn't kill that guy at that traffic stop.
Totally.
Total Red Auerbach.
Yeah, complete unsung hero. Look, the bottom line is, there's no month that celebrates the greatest general managers slash presidents, like real coaches in sports teams history. So why shouldn't Red Auerbach have an opportunity to shine? He does all those good things.
You know, the saying behind every successful black guy is a white guy that took a risk.
That's right.
Oh, it's blowing up on me again. Boston, talk about core brand proposition.
The dude,
that was amazing.
Look, the dude drafted Larry Bird, right? And look what that did for Magic Johnson's career. Who else was like, I mean, honestly, who's passing the ball to Parrish? It's unbelievable. Folks, window treatments. What does that mean to you? It's one of those soulless adulting terms for something necessary but boring AF.
I literally don't know what that means.
It really is a strange term, but I don't know what else. It's like, well, you know what it is. It's blinds.
Oh,
but I don't know why they call it window that. Treatments.
Treatment you don't even sounds think... like you're rubbing lotion on it.
which would streak the windows. You don't even think about them unless you move or they break. When they're right, everything in your house looks better. You don't even think about it. When they're wrong, everything in your home looks like garbage. But let's be honest, you take the time to pick out and buy blinds. Sounds like a pain. Sounds expensive. Installing them yourself sounds harder than any self-respecting adult wants to admit. But Blinds.com makes it super easy for you. Not sure what you want or even where to start? With Blinds.com, you get a free online design consultation. You send them pictures of your house or your apartment. They send back custom recommendations from a professional for what will work with your color scheme, furniture, and specific rooms. I went through this process. We already had shades, but we did it just to see what they would come up with. And everybody in my household was very happy. They'll even send you free samples to make sure everything looks as good in person as it does online. Every order gets free shipping. And here's the best part. And this, I just named this. This is called the Brooks Clause. If you accidentally...
This is a part of like not doing something?
Right. If you accidentally mismeasure or pick the wrong color, if you screw up, Blinds.com will remake your blinds for free.
I would pick the right color and have someone else measure it.
There,
boom.
There you go. That, I believe. In fact, I feel like you would farm out the color thing, too.
Yeah,
they
probably.
Really made it easy for you. There's no excuse to leave up those mangled blinds that make your place look like a set from The Wire. And for a limited time, get up to 20% off everything at Blinds.com when you use the promo code MAJORITY. That's 1/5, folks. I've just did that math in my head. That's Blinds.com. The promo code is MAJORITY. You get up to 20% off of everything. Faux wood blinds, real wood blinds, cellular shades, roller shades, more. Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY. Rules and restrictions apply. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to... I didn't get that one.
Oh, there is. I'm sorry. One second. Damn for a sec. I thought you did.
I did not. Bear with us, folks. One more message for you. Stamps.com, it's the easiest way to access all the amazing services of the post office. As you know, folks, I really am hesitant to leave the office or my apartment.
That's the
particularly
truth.
February has been brutal. January was also brutal. I feel like this whole winter has been brutal. Beauty with Stamps.com. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online. No equipment to lease. No long-term commitments. Then you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com will even help you decide what the best class of mail based upon your needs. They'll even send you a digital scale, which obviously automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com, they make it easy. Click, print, mail, and you're done. Like I say, I use Stamps.com because when I'm sending out merch, when I'm sending out DVDs, available at pilotseasondvds.com, I don't want to have to do anything to do that. Stamps.com makes it possible for me to do the absolute minimum. Right now, you can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in MAJORITY. Click on the microphone at the top of the page, click in the coupon code MAJORITY. That's Stamps.com, enter MAJORITY. All right, quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Professor of Law from Cornell University, Aziz Rana, on his piece, in N+1, Goodbye Cold War. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Law from Cornell University, Aziz Rana, on his piece, Goodbye Cold War, in N Plus One Online. Aziz, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
All right. So let's go through this piece here. I found it fascinating. And your argument is largely that, it starts with the assertion that the 2016 was the last election of the Cold War. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so we tend to think of the Cold War as basically a discrete conflict with a very specific adversary, the Soviet Union, that ended at a particular moment in time. So either 1989 or 1991. But my point is that it was actually a lot more than that. That what the Cold War generated were a set of views that were held really across both parties by national elites that came together in the mid-20th century. And these were views about domestic and foreign policy, about why the U.S. was exceptional, and really why it was morally superior to other nations. And to me, the key point is that actually perceived victory over the Soviet Union supercharged these assumptions. And in post-1989, they made them in a way like even more entrenched than they'd been during parts of the Cold War. Just think of, social conflict in the 1960s and 70s. And it's only now, for reasons that we can discuss, that that consensus has really broken down permanently. And I want to say that there are lots of problematic and troubling things about that breakdown, but there's also some good things about a kind of new openness when it comes to political possibility.
All right. I want to circle back around to that because I really, having grown up at least in part during the Cold War, and having some both political and just sort of contextual awareness during that time, it really did strike me, your piece. It reminded me of a dynamic that I think is largely switched or changed in how much our foreign policy impacted domestic politics and in such specific way. But before we get there, let's talk about the ideological openness pre-Cold War. Describe for us, largely like what that meant in both conceptually and practically.
Yeah, so I'd say that over the last year, there have been a lot of requiems for America. But really what people mean is an idea of the U.S. that was a contingent product of the Depression, World War II, and Soviet competition. And if we actually just look further back than the 1940s and 1950s, we'd see a U.S. that looks really different than what we've always taken for granted. So it's marked by open class conflict, where you have very powerful labor unions and a powerful labor movement that understands itself as effectively at war with business. We have extreme forms of inequality domestically. You have a constitutional system that's really dysfunctional because it has so many veto points. It makes it very difficult for ordinary citizens to just implement popular policy. White nationalism and the presumption that the country is a white republic is just a bedrock commitment that a majority of citizens have. And you have institutions like the Ku Klux Klan that are incredibly powerful, not just in the South, but in the North and the West, in places like Indiana and Oregon. And all of this creates a dynamic where you have really perhaps like the two most powerful popular political positions as a brand of kind of a mixture of white nationalism and ethnic populism on the right that links folks like, you know, Father Coughlin in the 1930s all the way back to Andrew Jackson. And then on the left, you have an emergent democratic socialist position that's interested in democratizing political institutions, strengthening the position of labor, confronting problems of race and class together as structural issues. So really, the country is marked by a recognition of intensive conflict and an understanding that, you know, maybe the problem is the basic institutions of government and economy, which have to be transformed.
And contextually, I mean, there was also, I mean, obviously we had, we're going into and I guess attempting to come out of the Great Depression during that time after coming in from a Gilded Age. And so it's interesting because on some level, the contexts are similar as well as not just the absence of the Cold War, but so we had that going on in the, you know, pre 1940, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then the World War II happens and is immediately sort of leads us into the sort of the post-war era and the Cold War. How much of, just tell us what you reckoned happened there in terms of change.
Yeah, so sorry to interrupt. Yeah, so I think that there are three kind of decisive events. There's the emergence of the New Deal coalition in the context of the Depression. There's the U.S. participation in World War II and its confrontation with Nazi Germany. And then there's the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union. So I can just quickly like link the three if you think that would be helpful.
Yeah, let's go through each one in terms of what the implications were for that pre-existing political order or I guess disorder.
Yeah. So the first with the New Deal coalition. So we have to remember, and this is again should be familiar with our contemporary constitutional system, is that most of the branches of government in the U.S. then as today are just not democratic. So you really only have one half of one branch, the House of Representatives, that's organized around principles really of majority rule. The Senate overrepresents historically like southern interests, but rural interests. You have the presidency that was indirectly elected, electoral college. You have the Supreme Court. And that it was the Depression that really actually strengthened the hand of labor, in particular unions like the CIO, to in part kind of take over and transform the Democratic Party and to give the Democratic Party massive supermajorities, what you needed in order to be able to implement policy. You couldn't just have ordinary majorities, you'd have to have rolling supermajorities. And these supermajorities produced all of the social welfare programs that we associate with the mid-20th century. And what they did is, in a way, kind of counterintuitively, they provided a legitimacy to American institutions and to the American economy because the economy was able to actually generate meaningful reforms. So that was a key thing that emerges in the 30s and 40s. The second thing was World War II, which is isolationism had always been perhaps the most common position when it came to American foreign policy. The U.S. was safe behind the oceans, that we shouldn't get involved in like the problems that you see in Europe. And the confrontation with the Soviet Union really undermined isolationist sentiment and emphasized the idea that the U.S. had a global responsibility and that this global responsibility was bound in a key way to not just anti-fascism, but to a commitment to racial equality. That Nazism and racism were kind of threats to the American way. And then that ends up connecting to what happens during the Cold War, which is The Soviet Union, you have to remember, was like a real competitor, an ideological competitor for hearts and minds across the world, and especially in a decolonizing global South. The Soviet Union has an account of economic development through state-managed policies. It has a commitment to anti-imperialism and anti-racism. And in this context, what Cold War elites rediscover is this idea of the American Declaration of Independence as highlighting how from the very founding, the U.S. has always been committed to universal equality and how the U.S.'s interests are the world's interests. And for that reason, it kind of deserves Gromyl preeminence. And so all of this fuses together to produce a set of views. When it comes to national identity, the U.S. is anti-imperialist to its core. It's committed to universal equality. When it comes to foreign policy, it has the right to be the first nation among equals, that it enjoys global preeminence because of the inherent justice of its own commitments. And when it comes to domestic policy, two things. The institutions are essentially just, the form of constitutional government, and the capitalist economy is essentially just. Both just need minor tweaks. And the proof of the justice of the institutions are the achievements of the New Deal period. And it's why, you know, the kind of old joke about the Democratic Party was that by the time you get to the 1950s, it's the second most pro-capitalist party on the face of the earth, only slightly behind the Republican Party.
So, okay. So I want to go back in and dig. That's a lot of stuff there to sort through. I mean, coming out of, and let's take the second one first. That is the essentially winning World War II, or being on the winning side, leading the winning side, creates this, global responsibility that the United States feels to be the leader of the free world, I guess. It also, it strikes me as, I mean, because it strikes me as we already have these imperialistic tendencies, right? The question was, do we have the capacity to go across the Atlantic? And on some level, right, World War II proves that, yes, we do. We have the capacity to go across the Atlantic. We have the capacity to go across the Pacific. And this is an extension of our manifest destiny in a way.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that there's certainly a story here about capacity. But I also think that it's really important to highlight how the World War II discredits isolationist sentiment. The anti-war views about World War I were incredibly powerful, and they continued to be powerful after the war ended on both the right and the left. And the specter of Nazi Germany and the confrontation with Nazi Germany, highlighted this idea that there's a fundamental difference between the U.S. and other potential competitors for global power. The U.S. is an open society. Those societies are totalitarian. The U.S. stands for pluralism, civil liberties, racial equality. Those other societies, if they actually enjoyed global dominance, would be real threats. And it made those views that were not just held by certain foreign policy elites, but just part of the drinking water of American life in a way that they hadn't been before. So it's both an issue of capacity, but it's also an issue of a set of positions that become powerful enough that they generate the capacity, because it's after World War II that you get the National Security Act, the emergence of the Defense Department, the entire national security infrastructure that we just take as given today.
And that also, I guess, in all of this on some level formulates a narrative that we're telling ourselves about ourselves that is structured in a way to, I guess, meet the challenge of the Cold War.
Absolutely. It's all about, explaining the moral distinctions between the U.S. and its perceived enemies. Like, why is the U.S. actually, ethically superior? And it has some really important effects. This is a central force in generating domestic racial reform, that it's the concern about winning hearts and minds, the worry that the U.S. is going to be viewed with suspicion in the global South if it allows Jim Crow practices to continue. The State Department actually submits an amicus brief in Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, saying that it's really important to overturn Plessy versus Ferguson for foreign policy ends. So it has these real ameliorative effects, But one of the things that I also argue is that the bargain really contains, I think, a lot of the transformative potential of 1930s labor and black politics. And over the long run, it produces a consensus that's really both unstable and is really, and at the end of the day, is just not up to the tasks of the kinds of social crises the country faces at repeated moments in time in the 1970s, and then really what we've witnessed over the last decade.
Okay, now specifically that bargain, you say, what is that bargain?
So you can look at it when it comes to like labor and race, and we can think of these two slightly separately. Like on labor, the bargain that really gets struck in the post-war is that the labor movement, which had understood itself, the CIO, as really a movement of mass insurgent democracy to democratize the economy, shouldn't be thought of in those terms. Instead, that you have three actors, government, business, and labor unions. Labor unions leave the prerogatives of how to manage business to the business side, and they essentially bargain exclusively over wages, certain types of benefits. And the state basically manages this, but this is a key thing, stays out of providing social benefits, like public goods, like healthcare, for example, to workers as just a right of citizenship. Instead, that stuff gets tied, it gets privatized. It gets tied to one of the benefits that business offers. And over time, what this does...
That business offers, but presumably it is a get by unions.
Exactly. That's precisely the point. Like, it's not a universal public good that you get as an American. It's just a right of being in this country. Instead, it's one of the things you negotiate with business over, that business controls based on other kinds of managerial prerogatives. And really, over the long term, what this ended up doing is it meant that, you know, labor became bound to the judgments that business made. And also another key element of this larger bargain was that unions, and you can think of the AFL-CIO in the 50s and 60s as a key example of this, left to government decisions about foreign policy. Like, you accept kind of Cold War patriotism. You don't contest Vietnam, because to contest Vietnam would imperil the kind of the gains when it comes to sort of benefits and wages.
How does that, I mean, explain to me how that works, that idea that questioning Vietnam, is it because, explain to me the mechanics of that, yeah, that questioning Vietnam as a union would imperil wages.
So, I mean, the way I would think about it is it's the shift that the unions experience from essentially being able to control part of the Democratic Party. So in the 1930s, you know, unions at like steel plants, you know, production sites, they're shutting down the economy. They're developing political action campaigns that are, you know, essentially running candidates, and they're controlling elements of the party, and they're generating these policies. By the time you get to the 50s, it's almost the inverse, where, you know, you got to remember that for many people that, you know, that got those jobs in the 50s, like those were hard won victories. And it felt like a kind of liberation that needed to be defended. And so for the Walter Earthers of the world, you know, you really needed to protect your relationship with the leadership of the Democratic Party. And that meant the way you protect your relationship is you ensure that you get like all the benefits that you can through collective bargaining, but you don't antagonize national politicians on issues that don't seem to be directly connected. The claim is that like the foreign and the domestic aren't directly connected. So why go out of your way to attack Cold War politics when, if anything, what it could do is imperil the position of your workers? And this is also after a period, like this is where the McCarthyism stuff comes in, of really intense blacklisting, and both communist and kind of popular front forces that had been so central in the 30s and 40s to the labor movement have all been eliminated. And so you have, you know, you just have an intellectual leadership in the labor movement that doesn't have in many ways the same kind of commitments and ambitions as 20 years previously.
Because they have now entered into a transactional relationship, and they've prioritized their gets. And so we're willing to give up, you know, a say in this sort of, I guess, national foreign policy narrative. And how much does Taft-Hartley also, I mean, I guess, structurally inhibit or structurally discipline unions at that time? And was there an awareness that that was happening with Taft-Hartley?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it absolutely does. So you're talking about the key bit of post-World War II labor legislation in 47 that was pushed by the Republican Party and that limits striking powers, really constrains secondary boycotts, all of these different elements that had been some of the tools of the labor movement. Yeah, and, you know, the unions fought hard against it. It absolutely has a shaping effect. But maybe this isn't the best analogy, but one way of thinking about this is think about Democrats from 2010 to 2016, which is, you know, the labor movement in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, they see themselves as like the winners. I mean, this is still the era of the New Deal coalition. It's powerful. It controls the institutions of government. It's gotten all these hard-won victories that it never achieved before. And so the rollbacks aren't experienced in quite the same way. You aren't thinking, right, well, this is creating the structural conditions for the ultimate inability of the labor movement to be able to contest the terms of state. Similarly, you know, you have the like 2010 election, you have all these losses at the state and local level, but you aren't thinking, well, this is actually, you know, hollowing out whatever might have been the benefits of the 2008 Obama victory.
Right. There's a little bit of myopia there, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, okay, so we now have the...
Can I just add one more thing? Like,
please.
There's also a race story that, you know, that I think is worth noting, which is that the race compact is that, you know, the country is basically racially just because it's always been free and equal from the founding, except, you know, for like these archaic practices of segregation that are tied to slavery, and that what racial equality means is just inclusion on formally equal legal terms, getting rid of segregation into the existing society. And that produces all of these great victories from like the 40s all the way through to the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. But the big thing that's missing in a way that's a parallel to the labor story is a failure to confront kind of like the persistent structural features of racism in the U.S. that aren't just about like formal disenfranchisement for middle and professional African Americans.
And part of the, I guess, the adoption of that narrative and that agenda is, and I think maybe you mentioned this, is that we now perceive ourselves as a nation following World War II as having a global responsibility and, I guess, maybe and global ambitions, and to essentially compete with the Soviet Union, we have to project to, you know, newly independent, I think you write, and sort of, I guess, at play non-white nations, essentially, that we are moving in the right direction, that we have this sort of long arc of racial justice, and we're dealing with our problems.
Absolutely. And so, and that plays out in all sorts of formal and informal ways, from, you know, trying to address those things domestically, to participating in various, you know, UN anti-racism conventions, to sending Louis Armstrong on State Department missions to Africa to talk about like the centrality of Black American culture to American identity. I mean, so all of this is really important, but it's double-edged. So it's important in that it actually produces real inclusion. I mean, this is why Obama and McCain can both believe so deeply in the Cold War story, because wealth was generated, excluded communities were included. There seemed to be real ethical differences between the U.S. and some of its adversaries. But it also had real problems, which is, you know, structural issues of both race and class were essentially allowed to fester, and they weren't addressed in a systematic way. And that kept on popping up again and again throughout American history. So it pops up in the 60s and 70s. And I think, you know, not to repeat myself, but it's come back with a vengeance over the last decade.
Yeah, I want to get up there. But before we leave that era, so, I mean, how much awareness was there contemporaneously, at the least on the left, and I'm curious actually on the right too, how much was this new, I guess, structure, this new, you know, narrative that had been largely adopted by the elites in both parties. In fact, I think, you know, I just did an interview, and I think we're going to be playing it next week about polarization. That in that era, the biggest complaint was that there was not enough polarization, that we had two parties who were basically so aligned that, I mean, this was the articulated complaint of, you know, like the establishment media at the time.
Yeah. So what I'd say is, you know, the key thing that's noteworthy is that you had growing agreement among national elites, but that didn't actually necessarily dovetail with mass public opinion or varieties of popular politics that persisted, both in the South with like a kind of built-in white supremacist politics, but also with various types of left formations. And just as like an example, so, you know, I've been doing work on American views of the Constitution. This is something that's sort of central to the book that I'm writing. And you have Gallup polls going back to the 30s about, you know, assessing, do Americans like their Constitution? Do they think it should be fundamentally changed? The period where you have a flip, there are more Americans saying in these polls that the Constitution should be fundamentally restructured than not, is like right after World War II. It's December 45. And the basic thought is that you actually have a majority of citizens that are thinking, well, you know, maybe we should have fairly significant changes to the economy, and that might mean structural changes to the Constitution.
Stick a flag in here and say how, you know, for someone who, when I was 9 or 10 years old, was brought to see the Constitution that was going around in a train, you know, around the country, the idea,
freedom trains.
Yes. The idea that there was a period within the 20th century where Americans were down on the Constitution. It's a little bit mind blowing. I mean, I've been reintroduced to that notion as an adult, but like for that entire period of time, the Constitution was like, and I think many people probably in this country still feel this way. It was like the Bible, you know, like a document that was just so pristine and perfect. I mean, how else would we all be here? It really is sort of stunning.
But, you know, part of what I'm arguing is, that was a conscious product of, you know, of policies generated by elites to reshape how people viewed the institutions of government. And that fit in real ways with the experiences people had. Like, wealth, again, was being generated. People were being included. Rights were being protected in the way that they hadn't been previously. But, you know, you just go back to the 30s. The classic position among African Americans within the labor movement was that was to think of the Constitution as a document for, you know, basically providing the instruments of decision making, like, you know, how government operates. And in those terms, it was really weak. So, you know, these views don't just disappear. But what I want to say is that they really get suppressed, and they get suppressed in ways that we forget. Like, so I mentioned in the piece, when Johnson is running for president in 64. This is a different era of the primary system. But he realizes that, you know, who's probably the most popular Democratic alternative at this point? It's George Wallace. And so how is it that you keep it? I mean, he's like, I'm going to win the nomination. Like, that's not the problem. But how do I keep there from being a significant, you know, primary fight? And, you know, it's a different era. So what his idea was is that you have, in each state where Wallace is contesting the primary, you have a really popular local politician on the ballot instead of Johnson. And that local politician wins the state and then pledges his delegates, because, you know, again, this is the 60s in the U.S. Right. And it's a him, but pledges his delegates to Johnson. But that's a function of realizing the power of these contested views. And you can say, tell the same story about the left. Like, you know, so in 68 and 64, you have really robust left politics that maintains a kind of historical memory with the 30s. You have the Mississippi Democratic Party that, like the politics of the 30s, sees, well, what's the point of racial reform in the U.S.? It's a project to truly democratize the institutions of state and governance. That's why it's called a freedom party. And so that operates even in the language of like SDS and the student movement, and elements of the labor movement. So all of this persists, and it pops up at various moments, and then it basically gets suppressed. And to me, like in many ways, the real break when it comes to our historical memory is post 89, because what the collapse of the Soviet Union does is it almost renders all of those conversations. So if elites really had to confront disagreement and figure out ways to contain it, like post 89, you know, all of those conversations now seem like antiquated and moot, you know, talking about alternatives to capitalism or, you know, the need for revolutionary change when it comes to race or challenging American Cold War foreign policy, you know, that in a way it's beside the point because victory just proves the goodness of the market, the justice of limited racial reforms, and the appropriateness, whatever the problems at the margins, of U.S. international interventionism during the Cold War.
So the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union is both a victory and a confirmation that we're on the right track, everything we're doing is working. And also probably adds a little bit of like, and now where else are you going to go? we're the only game in town.
Totally. And one of the things that it does, I mean, so this is where, you know, we might not have time to get into all the specifics of it, but when we think about like the rise of neoliberalism. So when Cold War ideas get reformed in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, in the context of all of these, there are economic crises, there's foreign policy crises, there's racial crises, that the new version really is, you know, a kind of market politics stripped of all of the old elements of social democracy that actually gave ethical substance legitimacy to the compact in the first place. I mean, the reason why people accepted the bargain is because you got certain tangible benefits like right. Social Security and unemployment insurance and collective bargaining. But the version of like the Cold War agreement that emerges post 89 is a version stripped of all of that. And it's just it's a hardcore commitment to privatization and austerity. It's a belief that like basically any social problem. So I don't know that we both remember the 90s. Basically, you know, you throw a dart at the wall, and if the wall has a social problem, you just solve it through some kind of market solution. School
right,
choice,
right.
Vouchers, privatizing prisons, like you name it.
The era of big government is over, welfare reform, Telecommunications Act. I mean, so broadly, just to bring us up to where we are now, the Cold War functioned both as a way of muting and in some ways co-opting the various ideologies along the spectrum, and because in a very simple sense, like we are all united on some level because of this this evil empire ultimately that is on the outside of us. We're in competition for that. That created both some positives in the way that we had to actually compete, I guess, globally, but it also tampered down some of these sort of more helpful ideologies. When the Soviet Union fails, all bets are off. And it's just that bargain becomes completely one-sided. There is a lot of self-satisfaction amongst the elite and a lot of vindication, and it goes forward. And like you say, Clinton in 93 and then Bush Sr., certainly, I would imagine, and or I should say vice versa, Clinton and then and George Herbert Walker Bush, they're all functioning on the validation that came from America essentially winning the Cold War. What's also interesting is to see Obama and McCain as two sides of the same coin on some level, of the various strains of that narrative that we told ourselves through the Cold War. McCain, you know, vindicating the America as, you know, an interventionist, a global interventionist, and Obama vindicating the America, you know, the arc of racial and economic justice. But then all of a sudden we realize not working out, and that's why we get someone like Trump and maybe someone like Bernie Sanders, because that we're outside that post-Cold War era.
Yeah, so and this is one of the reasons why one of the impulses for me in writing the piece is that I really felt like it was important not to tell sort of histories of the present, accounts of what sort of generated our current political climate, as purely explanations about how did we get Trump, because those tend to kind of naturalize Trump rather than see, like, you know, Trump's victory is totally contingent. You know, a couple things move differently. The Democratic Party is somewhat more actually responsive to its own base and doesn't clear out the field for a single candidate. And, you know, either Sanders ends up as the nominee and becomes president, or we have some other configuration of political circumstances. And so really, the rise of Trump is actually part of a broader development. And to me, what that broader development is that the Cold War solutions, so tied to market, interventionism, and limited racial reforms, they fail. And they fail pretty catastrophically between, you know, the early years of the 21st century and the 2016 campaign, from Iraq to the financial crisis to the rise of hyper and mass incarceration. And all of this produces, you know, rolling social discontent and years, you know, the last few years of really intense kind of popular rebellion. And the key thing during the Obama years, and this is where I think it's really important for people to think of themselves as progressive, to avoid the trap of a kind of Obama nostalgia, is that the Obama years, and you know, I have a lot of respect for Obama the person. I think he's a man of real integrity. But it was an effort to go back again to the kind of classic solutions. And those solutions proved to be really limited and inadequate. So you have more interventionism abroad in places like Libya and the politics in Afghanistan. You have more marketized social services. I mean, the things that people don't like about the ACA, about Obamacare, are all the ways in which it's not providing healthcare as a public good, but it's tied to the market. And you have more limited racial reforms like body cameras, sensitivity training, rather than addressing, you know, like the structural deep problems.
Right.
Yeah. So what this does is it means that by the
and,
time
and we
get
should
to
say place, the evidence of that is how easily, in fact, I mean, for a total incompetent as president and a completely, dysfunctional majority in Congress, how easy it is for them to unravel a lot of those things. I mean, the ACA is still here, but without a mandate, where you've got a lot of significant problems with that, the market-based part of it. And even on some level, you know, the Medicare stuff is still vulnerable to some rather, you know, easy sort of sabotages, I think you could describe them as. So, I mean, that's evidence of it, right? And we're seeing all the rollbacks of the executive orders and whatnot.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, and so what I think those rollbacks also, again, highlight are really the problems of our own version of presidentialism, which, you know, requires these supermajorities just to get anything done. And if you don't have them, what ends up happening is you have, you know, deadlock. And the way that for decades now American presidents have addressed that is through, you know, using executive action. And the problem with executive action is, and this is what we're seeing, unfortunately, during the Trump years, but we saw it during the Obama years too, is that it's really good at asserting violence. In other words, you know, attacks abroad, drone strikes, the treatment of immigrants, deportations. But it's not that good at permanently reshaping domestic policy.
Right.
And so you're in this position where, like, the institutions of government themselves, because of all of the problems of heightened polarization in the context of, like, a kind of collapsing Cold War agreement, are really accentuated. And then outside of the corridors of government, you have the return of these kind of classic pre-Cold War political positions. Like, it's the return of the repressed. So on the right is the return of white nationalism that Trump embodies. But just as important, and perhaps the most popular of any of these different ideological positions, is the return of democratic socialism. You know, Sanders represents a pretty common and widely supported view about the relationship between race, government, and the economy that kind of dominated the first half of American politics. You know, we forget that Henry Wallace was the most popular, so not George Wallace, but Henry Wallace, the sort of liberal line, Secretary of Agriculture, FDR vice president, was the most popular political figure within FDR's own cabinet.
I did forget that. I'm not even sure I knew that, relatively speaking, in his cabinet. All right, so let's jump to. I mean, you outline what the strength of the left is today is that there is more extra institutional power than we've seen, you know, at least in several decades, with noting that the power of unions has declined, but also with that understanding that there had also been some, I don't want to call it self-sabotage by the unions, but a depowering of unions by becoming more transactional. So, but you mentioned at the end, there are three major challenges. One is to harness this mass anger at the corruption of our political process. Two, to build the strength of unions. And three, to develop a left infrastructure to fill the bureaucracy, which is, I think, an exceptional point, particularly when you look at the context of Bernie Sanders, who, you know, entered in that race in 2016 without really any foreign policy people. And we can see, you know, him building up a staff as just a metaphor on some level of saying, like, we need to build, now that there's sort of like some ideological underpinnings, build people who can implement these policies from a vaguely technocratic perspective.
Yeah. So, I mean, my view, and I mean, and this is the optimistic side, is that there is a ton of political energy on the left. And indeed, there's a plethora of solutions to the kind of classic problems that the country faces, from, you know, how to deal with prisons, to how to deal with the financial sector, to what kind of foreign policy the country should pursue. But one of the real big problems is that the left basically is exclusively an extra institutional voice. And, you know, some of this is just about how politics emerged over the last few decades. Like, so one thing that's obvious, and we're seeing this in the context of the midterms, is that, so you have a centrist leadership within the Democratic Party that absolutely, despite the persistent failure of its own policies, the history of defeat over the last decade, just like refuses to cede the stage and is continuing to like back centrist candidates and Blue Dog and pro-business candidates.
Right.
But I think there's a deeper issue, which is if you're between 35 and 75, this is one of the reasons why like Sanders is kind of important as like an old person, or I should say as a person that's older. If you're between those ages, that if you are politically ambitious, you know, there are all of these cues about like what kinds of views would be necessary if you wanted to be like taken seriously. You had to have the same views as the people that were the grown-ups. Now, of course, it turned out like the grown-ups actually didn't have positions that were up to the challenges of the times. But what it did do is it contained and in fact eliminated, you know, generations of creative and imaginative political thinking.
Right.
And this is not just about candidates. It's about like, you know, the think tanks. Like
right.
What think tanks you'd go to, what organizations you'd join if you were in college, what types of fellowships were available to you if you wanted to get involved in foreign policy, like what kinds of jobs would be available to you if you wanted to be a legislative assistant to a senator or a congressman.
The center left media, I would argue, too.
Absolutely. And it's meant that now we're at a moment where you know, there's a reckoning, even if it's not quite reached the party and it hasn't entirely reached the center-left mainstream media, but there's a reckoning with the implications of these views. And there's lots of young people that have contesting positions, but they need to have like the institutional space to be able to actually develop. Like, well, what would be policy? What would be like the programmatic policy paper that goes with this? Like, how would you inculcate those kinds of commitments? And the way I sort of say it facetiously in the piece is like, let's say Sanders wins. You actually would have something like, quote unquote, like deep state, a deep state response to a truly left president coming out of elements of the security state, the carceral state, and business, you know, not this kind of like right-wing fever dream. And you'd have to figure out like, well, in that setting, like, well, who's the person that you'd have in a junior position in the National Security Agency, even if your whole goal in the National Security Agency would be to roll back some of the most, you know, deleterious effects of surveillance. Like, you actually have to have people that are knowledgeable enough to fill those positions.
Right.
You can't just put in like the, frankly, like the kids that have been trained by the DNC.
Right. Well, where is Bernie Sanders' Center for American Progress is another way of putting it. Or where is Bernie Sanders' Heritage Foundation or Federalist Society, those type of things. And I think your piece is optimistic that ultimately the Democratic Party will, if not be responsive, will be slowly will evolve into that vehicle for the left.
Well, so, I mean, I don't know if I'd go quite that far. What I would say is that my piece, one of the things I see my piece as is a warning against both nostalgia and something that's oftentimes connected to like political despair. And by nostalgia, I mean, don't fall into the trap that you see how, I mean, truly craven and terrible Trump and the people around Trump are and the Republican Party more generally. And you know, presume that what we had before was better, either in the form of Obama or even like, you know, the recuperation of Bush Jr. before Obama, that, you know, actually the truth of the matter is that, you know, the kinds of policies that we associate with the Cold War agreement generated real social problems and real violence and pain. So we should not look back glowingly on that period. And we should also not be despairing about the present, because the truth of the matter is that since Trump wasn't inevitable, you could tell the story of the present as the revival of a left politics that we haven't seen really in decades. When I was growing up, forget about calling yourself a socialist. No politician in the Democratic Party, or very few, would be willing to call themselves liberal.
Yep.
Now we're at a moment in which the basic questions about, you know, the structural features of white supremacy, patriarchy, and capitalism are actually being contested. Now, that doesn't mean that the left is going to win or build a kind of cross-racial, class-conscious coalition that I'd like to see emerge. But it does mean that we're at a moment of what amounts to real political struggle over like the central terms, and that can actually generate transformative change for the better. It also means to me that we got to be really wary about misreading if there is a wave election in 2018. That, you know, it's very possible because of just how incompetent and, you know, to use yet another adjective like grotesque, Trump and the people around Trump are, that, you know, the centrists in both parties might be back in charge. And the way to read that is, well, okay, we've kind of put, you know, we've put Humpty Dumpty back together. This was all an aberration. We can go back to sort of the sureties of what we assumed, quote unquote, America was about. And, you know, my view is that if that ends up being the lesson, we're going to see the same cycles play out again. It might work for... might work in 2020, might work in 2022, but the basic problem is those centrist perspectives are not up to the challenges that are perennial challenges in the U.S., and they're going to just necessarily produce their own instability and breakdowns, and then we're going to be faced with the same set of problems again.
Aziz Rana, the piece is Goodbye Cold War. We will link to it over at N Plus One magazine at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. We will play some audio of horrible human beings and some one or two nice people.
Got some good ones, actually.
We've got some good ones today.
Two heroes.
Two heroes. No goats. You know, it was nice. I mean, this is apropos maybe a little bit of what we've just heard. A little bit. Teamsters, we've talked quite a bit about how ICE is been unshackled, and we're now starting to see some pieces in the mainstream media about it. Washington Post had a piece that the agency made over 37,000 non-criminal arrests in the government's 2017 fiscal year. That's more than twice the number of the previous year. Those facing deportation who show up for periodic check-ins with ICE to appeal for more time in the United States can no longer be confident that good behavior will spare them from detention. The good news, I don't know if it's good news, but it's not, it's somewhat positive. Two things. One, a federal court in California ruled the other day that the L.A. County Sheriff's Department violated the constitutional rights of thousands of inmates that the agency detained for federal immigration authorities without probable cause. So basically, I guess the process works, and maybe Ronald Reagan will tell us, though. The ICE issues detainers, which are requests to hold inmates for up to 48 hours so that ICE can take those individuals into custody. But these are not warrants. These are not court orders. So the court found that they amounted to new arrest under the Fourth Amendment without any probable cause. No judge has looked at these detainers. It's just ICE issuing a request. So the department's policy is now defunct, which means that L.A. County will not be functioning as an illicit branch of ICE, essentially. And also positive, New York State Teamsters are getting prepped to become a sanctuary union. So in 27 shops, business agents, supervisors, and frontline workers are getting schooled on their rights under U.S. law and when and how to challenge federal immigration agents who show up at their work sites. That's pretty good.
Hell yeah.
So good for the Teamsters.
There's that left internationalism.
There you go. All right. Well, we're going to, on that note, we're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible day in, day out. Can't do it without our members. If you have the resources to become a member, head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member. You can also do a one-off donation there. And if you want, and as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day that you can choose to use or lose or snooze or peruse. I'm very proud of myself. But if you want that extra content and you don't have the financial means, and for a lot of people, if you're out of work, if you're having to care for a parent, an elderly parent, or whatever it is, people enjoy hearing the extra content every day. Send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have some patience. We got a vacation coming up. I'm going to get through a lot more emails during that time. We will set you up. We will set you up. We will. No one will be turned away for financial reasons. Also, a reminder, just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Tuesdays, we'll bring you TMBS via our YouTube channel or iTunes. Jamie's got some new content up at patreon.com/JamiePeck.
Newish. Definitely read it if you haven't.
Right. If you haven't read it, it's new to you. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back with the fun half.